Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Imagine if we can zoom right into the cells of your body and pinpoint which ones carry those inherited genetic blueprints that heighten your risk for cancer. What if we could then actually see how these seemingly normal cells are being, you know, subtly nudged towards malignancy even before any full-blown cancer shows up? For an aggressive disease like esophageal adenocarcinoma, which, well, it's rapidly increasing and often progresses silently from a benign precursor condition, that kind of insight, it would be a profound game changer. It really makes you ask, how could this fundamentally change how we detect and maybe even prevent this devastating disease, perhaps years before it becomes untreatable? Today, we're embarking on a deep dive into precisely this question. Our mission is to dissect a really groundbreaking scientific paper. It uses cutting-edge single-cell analysis to uncover the crucial cellular players influenced by our inherited genetics, the ones driving the progression from Barrett's esophagus to adenocarcinoma. And today, we want to celebrate the remarkable work of Martin C. Wenzel, Pouria Dasme, Patrick S. Plum, and their colleagues. That includes lead contacts Johannes Schumacher and Axel M. Hilmer from institutions like the University of Cologne and the University of Marburg. The recent paper, it's titled Single-Cell Analysis of Barrett's Esophagus and Carcinoma, reveals cell types conferring risk via genetic predisposition, and was published on October 8, 2025, in Cell Genomics. It has genuinely advanced our understanding of the cellular and genetic drivers behind esophageal adenocarcinoma.
It really has. And it's tackling such a critical and, frankly, urgent problem, esophageal adenocarcinoma, or EAC. Well, it carries a concerningly low 5-year survival rate. What's particularly alarming, though, is that its incidence has just been on this dramatic rise globally over the past few decades. So understanding its origins and how it progresses is absolutely vital. The primary precursor to EAC is this condition called Barrett's esophagus, or BE. Essentially, it's a metaplasia. That just means a change in the lining of the esophagus. The normal flak cells transform into a tissue that looks more intestinal-like. It's often a complication of chronic gastroesophageal reflux disease, you know, GERD. What makes BE so significant, really, is that it drastically increases a patient's risk of developing EAC. We're talking typically by a staggering 10 to 50 fold.
Right. So let me just make sure I'm following this. We're talking about a progression that often starts with chronic acid reflux, right? That leads to inflammation, which then causes this cellular change, this Barrett's esophagus. And that specific condition is the major stepping stone, like a high-risk state towards this aggressive cancer. And for years, we've been trying to fully map out that whole journey.
Precisely, yeah. And while previous studies using single-cell RNA sequencing CRNA-seq, they've certainly shed light on the cell of origin for BE itself, our understanding has remained a bit limited. We haven't fully grasped which other cell types, you know, beyond those initial metaplastic ones, really contribute to the progression from BE to EAC, especially when you look at it through the lens of inherited genetic risk. That was the crucial knowledge gap this new research aimed to fill.
Okay, that does sound like a critical gap. So how big a leap in understanding is this paper making? What specific questions were they asking that maybe previous research couldn't quite get at?
Well, it's sort of a fundamental shift in perspective, I'd say. Instead of just looking at general inflammation, which we know is involved, this paper really dives into how our germline genetic risk, you know, the inherited variations you get from your parents, the ones in nearly every cell might be quietly influencing specific cells, pushing them towards malignancy. This study didn't just look at the cells, it looked at how that inherited predisposition interacts with them, right at the cellular level. Their approach was, well, remarkably innovative. They used single-cell RNA sequencing, scRNA-seq, to profile individual cells from patient tissues. This lets you capture which genes are active in each distinct cell type. It's incredibly detailed. Then, and this is the really clever part, they integrated the cellular activity data with existing genome-wide association study, or GLOVIS data. GLVOS studies, as you know, identify common genetic variants linked to diseases. By combining these two powerful data sets, they could ask much more precise questions.
Questions about where genetic risk actually manifests at a cellular level.
Exactly. Where does the rubber meet the road, genetically speaking? For this study, they collected tissue samples from 9 patients. 5 had BE and 4 had EAC. And crucially, for each patient, they didn't just take the diseased tissue, they also collected samples from normal esophageal tissue and normal gastric fundus tissue. All these samples were then dissociated into single cells and sequenced using 10x genomics technology. That's really a state-of-the-art method for this kind of high-throughput single-cell analysis.
Okay, so they've got this incredibly detailed map of gene activity in all these different cells, normal, precancerous, cancerous. Mm. And they also have the map of known genetic risk addresses from the GW studies. How did they actually overlay these maps? What was the analytical trick?
Right. The key method they used is called partitioned heritability analysis, using something called LD score regression, or LDSR. It's a bit technical, but think of it like this. Imagine your DNA has specific address markers already known to be linked to BE or EAC risk from those GWS studies. This method essentially asks, okay, for a specific cell type, are the genes that are actively working inside that cell type found disproportionately close to those known genetic risk addresses? It's like finding a hotspot of unusual activity right next to a known danger zone in the genome for that specific disease.
Ah, I see. So it's connecting the what's active with where the risk lies.
Precisely. And to make sure their findings were specific, they also included negative controls. They looked at risk locations for major depressive disorder and lung cancer. And crucially, these showed no significant enrichment for the BE or EAC risk genes. That really helped confirm their method was picking up relevant disease-specific genetic signals, not just random noise.
That's smart. So with such a sophisticated and validated approach, what were the key revelations? What did they uncover? Was there anything particularly surprising?
Oh, definitely. The biggest shocker, I think, was this. The development of EAC, the actual cancer, seems to be driven to a greater extent by these local cellular processes influenced by inherited genetic risk, compared to the initial development of BE itself. Out of 31 distinct cell types they analyzed, 15 showed significant enrichment for B and or EAC risk locations. But here's the critical part. 10 of those cell types showed stronger enrichment for EAC risk loci versus only 5 showing stronger enrichment for BE risk.
Wow, so the genetic influence is kind of ramping up as it moves towards cancer.
It appears so. And this finding was robust enough that they even validated it using a completely independent single-cell RNA sequencing dataset. That adds a lot of confidence, and here's probably one of the most pivotal findings. These cells called intestinal metaplasia cells, now these are non-malignant cells found in both BE and EAC tissue. They showed the strongest genetic link to EAC risk among all the non-malignant cell types they looked at. But interestingly, their link to just BE risk, the precursor stage, was much weaker. This profoundly suggests these cells aren't just innocent bystanders. They seem to play a critical role in the malignant transformation to EAC, and that role is directly influenced by our inherited genetic blueprint.
So hang on, these intestinal metaplasia cells, they're not cancer yet, but they're found in both BE and EAC, and they carry the strongest genetic signal for cancer risk. It sounds like they're acting as some kind of bridge, maybe, specifically pre-programmed by our inherited genes to be a key turning point towards aggressive cancer.
That's exactly the implication. It's like they're a crucial intermediate step, genetically primed for that transition.
That's a potential game changer for where we might look to intervene, isn't it? Can you describe these cells a bit more? What distinguishes them?
Yeah. Visually, they have these goblet cell-like features, and they express a key marker usually found in intestinal stem cells called OLFM4. They're essentially esophageal cells that have transformed, taken on the tall, column-like shape and characteristics you'd normally find in the intestine. And the trajectory analysis they did, which sort of maps the developmental relationships between cell types, it clearly positioned these intestinal metaplasia cells as the closest non-cancer cell type to the actual malignant cells. So yes, physically and developmentally, they form a bridge in the disease progression. They also identified specific marker genes for these cells, genes like RG4, CDH17, ANPEP, MUC17, FEP2, and these genes overlap with other columnar differentiated cells and are already known to be linked to things like proliferation, invasion, and differentiation in cancer. It reinforces their suspected role.
Okay, so intestinal metaplasia cells are a huge part of the story. Were there other cell types that show these significant genetic links?
Yes, absolutely. Beyond those intestinal metaplasia cells, other types also showed involvement. For instance, a specific type of fibroblast called esophageal fibroblast 2. These were actually found in normal esophageal tissue, yet they showed enrichment for both EAC and BE risk loci. That's fascinating because it suggests a role for what we might think of as normal tissue components, not just the cancer-associated fibroblasts we usually focus on.
Normal fibroblasts contributing, that's unexpected. What else?
Even endothelial cells, the cells lining our blood vessels, seem to be involved. Two types, esophageal endothelial cells too, and gastric endothelial cells, mostly found in normal esophagus and stomach fundus tissue, were significantly enriched for BE and EAC risk variants. This hints at their involvement, possibly through processes like neoangiogenesis, the formation of new blood vessels, which we know is critical for tumor growth.
And the immune system, does inherited risk play a role there too?
It seems so, but in a distinct way. Certain immune cells, specifically plasmacytoid dendritic cells and CD4 plus memory T cells, showed exclusive enrichment for BE risk loci only. This suggests that the adaptive immune system, influenced by our germline genetics, contributes specifically to the initial development of BE. It seems separate from the later cancer progression drivers.
That's a really complex picture with many different players. What about the actual cancer cells themselves? Did they all show the same strong genetic risk signal for EAC?
No, and that's another really interesting point. They found that the tumor cell clusters actually showed varied enrichment for EAC risk loci. Some clusters, like ones they labeled EACO2 and EACO4, had strong enrichment, but others, like EACO1, had basically none.
Huh. So different tumors might get there through different genetic routes.
Exactly. It suggests that different EAC tumors might arise from distinct inherited genetic vulnerabilities, each following its own particular cellular pathway to malignancy. And importantly, data from an independent study by Nowicki Osach and colleagues also pointed to the strong link between columnar cell differentiation and EAC risk, specifically showing columnar differentiated cells exclusively enriched for EAC risk loci. It adds weight to the findings.
Okay, let's try and connect this to the bigger picture then. What's the main shift in understanding here?
Well, I think this study profoundly shifts our understanding. It really confirms that these germline genetic risk factors aren't just some vague background susceptibility. They actively influence BE and EAC development through specific local cell types. And critically, with a substantially stronger impact on EAC development, the cancer stage, than on BE, the precursor stage.
Right. So it's not just about the damage from reflux and general inflammation driving BE anymore, although that's still important, of course. But this work suggests that specifically for EAC development, our individual genetic predispositions are strongly influencing the local cellular environment in a much more direct, almost targeted way.
Yes, it's like a genetic bullseye on particular cell types rather than just a broad inflammatory effect.
That feels like a powerful revelation. What are the potential implications then? Where could this lead?
Well, the immediate thought is diagnostic potential. Those markers that characterize the columnar epithelial cells, especially within the intestinal metaplasia cells, genes like REG4, CDH17, OLFM4, they could potentially become incredibly valuable tools for predicting EAC risk much earlier. Imagine being able to identify individuals at highest risk and intervening sooner, maybe even before malignant changes really take hold. That would be huge.
That potential for earlier detection, maybe even prevention, is truly exciting. But this study is observational, right? It shows associations. So what needs to happen next? What are the burning questions?
Right, exactly. A major next step is functional validation. We need lab experiments to really confirm these cell type interactions and the effects of these genetic variants, see them in action, so to speak. Then there were those fibroblasts. We need to explore the role of these normal fibroblasts, more not just the typical cancer-associated ones. What are they doing? And the endothelial cells digging into how blood vessels and neoangiogenesis contribute is critical.
And the immune connection you mentioned earlier. How germline genetics affects the immune response in BE.
Yes, that's another key area. How do these inherited factors influence the immune system's ability to spot and maybe eliminate these premalignant cells in BE? Understanding that could open up immune-based prevention strategies. And finally, we really need longitudinal studies. Following patients with BE over time, comparing those who progress to EAC versus those who don't, that's essential for identifying reliable prognostic markers from tissue samples.
Of course, there are always limitations to consider with studies like this.
Absolutely, we have to acknowledge them. Sample sizes in these complex single-cell experiments are often relatively small, and getting large data sets of confirmed progressors versus non-progressors is inherently challenging. Plus, as you said, these are observational findings showing strong associations. They still require that functional confirmation to fully understand the cause and effect mechanisms, but even with those caveats, the insights gained here are substantial. They really do push the field forward quite significantly.
So, to wrap up the key message from this deep dive, Inherited genetic risks for esophageal cancer aren't just some vague general predisposition. They actively involve specific cell types, especially those intestinal metaplasia cells, which seem to act as a crucial transition point from benign Barrett's esophagus to aggressive adenocarcinoma. And the research really pinpoints these local cellular processes, heavily influenced by genetic factors, as significantly driving the development of the cancer, EAC, even more so than the precursor condition, BE.
Exactly. The big question this leaves us with is, what does this mean for how we screen for and prevent esophageal adenocarcinoma? How can we use this knowledge, potentially even before malignant changes become fully apparent?
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.